Welcome to Trick Talkers, a podcast about trick talk. Ooh, I can't. I finally got tripped on it.
Yeah,
I always make fun of you for doing it.
You've got to keep that in. Please keep it in.
Welcome to Trick Talkers, a podcast about trick takers, shedders, climbers, and other card games. I'm Ryan.
I'm Patrick.
And as we say in our intro, every time we always say Trick Talkers. I did it again. Man, I don't know what about this episode.
You've got Trick Talkers on the mind.
I do. We say trick takers, shedders, climbers, and we also say other card games. And we don't talk about those other card games. We just talk about the trick taking, shedding, and climbing games. And we thought it'd be a cool idea to start a little side series within our Trick Talkers universe, if you will, called Oops, No Trick Takers, where we talk about all of the other card games that we've been playing recently. And while in these series, we're not going to talk about a single trick-taking, shedding, climbing game, they are going to be card games, which I feel like for most people who like trick-taking, climbing, shedding games, which all involve cards, might have a close step into getting into the card games and enjoying those. So that's kind of the idea behind this series that we wanted to do. So I think, Patrick, if you want to start us off with the first game you've been playing recently.
Yeah, so the first game on the list is Eggs of Ostrich. Now, very peculiar name for a game and very peculiar art to accompany it. I'm sure you would agree.
100%. I almost think it's borderline not safe for work if we talk about in detail what the artwork looks like. But
yes, I would agree. And some of the ostriches, broadly speaking, the deck has many ostriches on the cards in all kinds of different weird positions.
Yes, weird.
I'm going to say weird. We're keeping it family friendly here. And then there are people who are native or tribal, people trying to capture the eggs from the ostriches. And again, just the overall art style is extremely wild. I've said peculiar. That's probably a Britishism here, Ryan, for I'm sure you can imagine what it's for, but we'll keep it at that for now. Anyway, we've just given you a weird name for a game, told you it's got weird art, and we haven't really said what the weird twist is, because that's also a thing. So the game is full of these little white egg things, which look like small Go tokens. And it also contains some transparent ones that are supposed to represent ambers, which are pretty cool. So the idea is that everybody has four sacks, so there are three players, and that's the other strange thing with this game. It's just a three-player game. So everyone gets four sacks. They are have got different numbers on them, and the idea is that you every round, you put a card in the middle, everybody flips it over, and that determines what egg sack you want the eggs to go into. And just to give you a little bit of context, there are a deck of ostrich cards which tell you how many eggs are available that round. So you, for example, there are five eggs available and everybody's going to then say what basket they would like those eggs to go into. The eggs are divided between the players. And if somebody decides to play a pass card and not want to take eggs that round, what you might find is, with this game, somebody has overloaded your basket. So you don't want to take too many eggs into your baskets, because your baskets can collapse because under the weight of all these ostrich eggs that you're collecting. So the idea is to put the optimal amount of eggs into your basket, which is the number that is on the egg basket. And this is really quite weird and complicated for me to explain, but you have a set criteria. You're trying to get that criteria to score the most points. And at the same time, players are trying to tip you up, ruin your basket. There are also ambers, which are worth more points, and you're trying to capture those as well in the center. And to get the ambers, only one person can play a pass card. If more than one person plays a pass card, that amber is not up for grabs. And just for context, when you play a card, you put it next to you, you don't get that card the next round, but then it comes back into play afterwards. So we've seen games where these ambers have been very, very hard to get. We think it's easy because you just play a pass card, but it's really not. Ryan, what is your perspective? I'm talking a lot of garbage about ostriches and sacks and eggs, and I realise anybody who's listening to this is probably scratching their head at this point. So throw me a bone here, or an egg if you like.
Yeah, the eggs of ostrich is, as we sort of said, a very silly and weird game. The three-player only aspect of it makes it very peculiar. And the simultaneous play of playing all of... You play your card face down, everyone does it at once, then reveals it, and seeing what numbers were played and where your eggs get distributed is always up for very fascinating gameplay, because the idea of trying to get your bags to have the right amount in them, because Patrick said, you know, when you get too many eggs in a basket, it breaks that basket. Well, with scoring, if a basket is broken, you don't score for that basket. But the other thing is, you also lose that card for the rest of the game. So when you start to play those cards simultaneously, and like Patrick said, when you play a card, it puts put to the side, you can't play that same card the next round. Well, when you lose numbers, you start to get limited to the number of cards that you can play and what you can cycle. And in this game, there's sort of a bluffing element of, oh, well, if there's 10 ostrich eggs out and my number five basket has two eggs on it already, well, a three-player only game, if all three of us take eggs, we're going to take three apiece. So if I play my five, I'm going to get the perfect amount of eggs on it. But the other two players at the table probably know I'm going to choose my five card because it would just make sense in that situation.
Yeah.
So if they haven't played their pass card yet, there's probably a good chance they're going to play their pass card. So now I'm thinking, well, one of them's probably going to play their pass card, so I can't do my five. What are my other options? And this is all happening at the same time of people thinking this same stuff of bluffing and double bluffing of, you're not going to play your pass card, because what if an amber comes up? If you play your pass, it's not available to then
you
do on the
got it available.
Yeah. And it's like a 15 minute game, maybe 20 minutes, depending on how AP someone might get. But it's a pretty quick game. And just those decisions that you can make on try not to bust that are really neat. They can make you look at the bluffing of placing in those baskets and what you're going to do every time. Almost a little stressful, but to me, I think it's good stress.
I see it, Ryan, as this game has a bit of a meta game that you can take through into next time plays, and you can say, oh, well, you know, I know this person, or whenever an amber comes up, they always do this X, Y, and Z, and kind of a little mini meta game, if you like, that you transfers between plays, which is really nice. Get into the headspace of your opponents. Are they bluffing or aren't they? The only downside of this game is that it's so hard to find an original copy. I believe I took, and I'm sorry to the world, one of the designer's last remaining copies from Japan. But there are other ways people can get their hands on this. Right, Ryan?
Absolutely. We've mentioned Schultze before. They make print and plays of a lot of really hard to find games. And Eggs of Ostrich is one of those games that they created a print and play for, which is called Eggs of Porg.
Is that a Star Wars theme on the porg?
Yes, Star Wars. It is a porg, which is like a type of species in the Star Wars universe.
Okay.
So the cards, yeah, instead of being ostriches, are porgs, which is kind
of
funny.
Of course they are.
Yeah. But to me, this is one of my favorite simultaneous action bluffing games. When the first time I ever played this was back at the 2022 PGC Con. When I visited, I was there for almost a week. So a couple days before the actual convention, Lee, Brandon, and I played this game. And I instantly fell in love.
Instant connection with ostriches.
Yeah. So in two episodes now, I've said my favorite game from the convention was Pups. And that's because I was always talking about a trick-taking game, which trick-taking, climbing, shedding game was my favorite, and that was Pups. If I was to say what was my favorite game overall, Eggs of Ostrich would hands down be it. That game was on my mind the entire time. And as soon as I played it, I wanted to play it again. And we played it, I think, three times in a row. And the very next day, we went over to another person's house and they had a copy of it. And I was like, we need to play that. They were like trying to offer, well, what should we play? We've got like 2 hours to kill. What's something we should play? And, you know, Boast or Nothing, Ambient Abyssal, all, you know, trick-taking games got brought out. I was like, no, we're playing Apes of Ostrich right now. This game is so good. We're playing that. And we ended up playing like six games of it. It's quick.
So, yeah, like you said, you can just literally do that. You can play this game, the game's over in 10 minutes, if that, and then be like, right, should we just do another one? Or just, and time flies. This is poached and scrambled above the rest. I have to get that in there now, Ryan. Great game, difficult to find, difficult player count because you need just exactly three of you, which is always awkward when that fourth person turns up and you're like, can you just wait over there for 5 minutes while I get my Eggs of Ostrich fix, right? That's always the difficulty.
Yeah. I personally think that this game would be fun to watch, though. So if a fourth person does show up, like, I feel like they could get engaged and watch the players and egg them on, if you will.
Oh, there we go. You've got to be yoking.
Yeah. Oh, no. We got to stop these puns. That's too many puns. No, I feel as though this is a game that's just as enjoyable to watch as it is to play. Seeing people and almost trying to guess what other players are going to do when they're all picking their cards. Because like I said, if I have two in my five basket and there's 10 eggs out there, I'm more than likely going to pick my five, but the other players are going to pick their pass. So if you're watching it, it's just really cool to try and guess what all three players might pick as their cards. Yeah. And like it almost allows sort of a, like you said, the meta to build of the game. And you could almost rotate players in and out as you do it. To me, it would be a game that I would enjoy watching.
So just a quick, as an interesting FYI here, Mr. Ben, who is also on the PGC Discord, there is a four-player eggs variant of, or say a four-player eggs variant, a four-player variant of this game on BGG. And I asked Mr. Ben to create a PMP of it a long time ago because I couldn't find it anywhere, and he kindly agreed, and we ended up with a Final Fantasy Chocoberry, I believe that's the creature, Chocoberry version of Eggs of Ostrich. And then subsequently, I found a copy of Eggs of Ostrich from the designer and sadly forgot all about it up until this moment. It's kind of been on the back of my mind somewhere, you know, with the influx of games. And I'm very curious to see if anybody has tried this four-player Eggs of Ostrich variant. It's still the same game. You just include more cards, more ambers. Because it would be really cool when you think about it, wouldn't it, to be able to support four players in this game, because the concept's phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I could easily see it becoming four-player.
Yeah.
There isn't really a limitation to it always requiring only three players. Like you said, you just need more cards and more amber, maybe potentially more higher numbers on the ostriches, so that way when they're split between four players instead of just three, it could work. But that would be interesting thing to try for sure.
There we go. We'll send a petition off to Japan, and hopefully the designer will put this game out there again so other folks can find it. But I saw a few of these for trade on BGG, etc. So it's not impossible to find out there, especially not in the second-hand market. So keep your eyes peeled, for those eggs.
Yeah, and I do want to shout out real quick, Brandon, the guy I played this game with the first time, absolute gentleman, and he had two copies of this game. Obviously saw how much I loved the game and how much I was talking about it and constantly thinking about it and nonstop saying I wanted to play this game, that on the last day before I left from Portland to come back home, he was trying to sneak it into my duffel bag and just like put it in there so I'd find it later. But unfortunately, I was like changing and grabbing some of my clothes for that day and ended up seeing it like as he was putting it in. So I was able to like talk to him about it, but he was like, oh, yeah.
Sorry, Ron, I just want to stop you. You were sort of changing half naked and some guy was trying to shove a copy of Eggs of Ostrich into you.
No, it wasn't at the same time.
Right,
I know okay. This game is maybe not safe for work, but this story is very much safe for work.
No,
it was, he had put it there. I was then way later getting some of my clothes.
Right. You weren't violated to get by an ostrich. Okay.
Correct. But just wanted to point out how awesome it was that Brandon was able to give me that copy. Just every time I play that game, it's always full of laughs. And while I will say it gets a little samey.
Yes, it can do.
Yeah. After probably like 5 or 6 plays, you've kind of seen it all. The fact that just the laughs that come from that game and how quick it is why I enjoy it so much. It can get to the table just because of that bluffing nature of the game. While the game itself can be samey, the bluffing can always be a little bit different if you choose it to be different. There are very obvious moves to make in this game. When an amber comes out, knowing to pass or not, if multiple people still have their pass cards, 99% of the time, they're both going to put their pass cards. When you can see somebody needs an exact number of eggs, depending on the ostrich that comes out, you'll know the card they want to play. 99% of the time, they're going to play it anyways because it's going to work out for them.
Yeah.
So it can have that issue. But the fact that there are just some of those moments where it doesn't happen.
It doesn't work out the way you expected, right?
Yep. And you end up, you know, your two bag busts because you end up getting all 7 of the ostrich eggs because the other two players pass. It just can be funny. It can create really hilarious moments in such a small package. And if you, of course, have the original game, the art just adds to that silliness.
Yes.
Yeah. And while I'll probably figure out how to bleep as I edit, I do want to say this because every time I introduce this game to players who haven't played it, I always call this the game Ostriches That Want to Get
I think that pretty much summarizes it. I'm sure people can translate the bleep.
Yep.
But when I played this game, Ryan, literally some of the players for the first time were taking photos of the ostrich cards and sending it off to their friends. Oh my God. We are playing this game. Have you seen the art? Because it's definitely, if you're not laughing when you're playing the game because of the game and the bluffing mechanics, you're laughing at the artwork. It is a laughter generator. 10 minutes of guaranteed laughter. Pull it off the shelf every few weeks. Keep it fresh. Try it with a few different groups and sit back and enjoy the eggs. Where'd you go from there?
Yeah, enjoy the ride, I guess.
Yeah, well, that is one way to put it.
Yeah. So before we move on to the next game, because we've talked about Eggs of Ostrich, I feel like probably too long here.
You can never talk about Eggs of Ostrich for too long. That's
of course not. So if you've been listening to our podcast enough, and at this point we have a lot of episodes out, so there's enough evidence that you could listen back to and hear me say these. Whenever I talk about a game, I have very few descriptors that I use, unfortunately. I'm not great at English. English is not a good language for me, even though it's my primary language. And whenever I describe a game, I'm usually using the words interesting, neat, or clever. Patrick, and I'm sure, can attest
to this.
That's
pretty clever. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've joked about this for a while now, where I've told Patrick and Johnny this, that I want to start almost an award system where if there's a game that I think is so interesting that beyond just calling it an interesting game, I want to give it the interesting award.
That's interesting.
Right? It's so interesting. Yeah. And to me, Eggs of Ostrich fits the interesting award and deserves, I feel like, the inaugural first time interesting award that I'm going to give out.
Wow. That is quite a step. That's the first interesting award that's ever been given on Trick Talkers.
It is. And I feel like there's probably been other games we've talked about that probably could have deserved it if I started the award system sooner.
Yeah.
But this game is so fitting for the interesting award because of the fact that, to me, what defines, to give listeners the idea of going forward, if I use this interesting award more, is it's going to be a game that might not be the best game. It's not going to be a 10 out of 10 game. It's not going to be amazing. Whether it's for me or for you, obviously everybody's going to be different with how they look at a game, and it might be your best game ever. It might, while it's not mine. To me, it's always going to be a game that's going to elicit laughs and is going to give you decisions at every point in the game. There's going to be some times where you're going to have to make a choice that is interesting. And this game, I feel like, does that perfectly. Every card play, while it might be samey as you've played the game a lot of times, there are always interesting choices to make. The ambers come out. Is your pass available? Do you play it? There's a nine ostrich that's bent over, ready to be...
Yeah, ready to be bleeped. And do you know what the funny thing is I like it because we were talking about Eggs of Ostrich, and then you were like, oh, we spent too long on Eggs of Ostrich. I said you could never spend too long on it. And now you've gone back and given it an award. You couldn't make it up. It's brilliant. But
it's even more interesting.
Now it's even more interesting. I'm really curious to see what games get this Ryan interesting award as we progress through these episodes, and then make sure we write them down so we can reflect on them at the end of the year and see if you still,
if they're still deserve the interesting award.
Yeah, see if they're still interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm here for it. Awesome. Well, I feel like now's the appropriate time to move on to our next game that we had on the list, which is going to be Drones versus Seagulls. And I feel like this one we could probably spend a little bit less time on, especially since Eggs of Ostrich just took up a decent chunk of the episode. I have talked about Drones versus Seagulls in the past. I'm going to be honest, I don't remember which episode it was, so you're going to have to figure that out.
You have spoken about it in the past. You are...
It might have been... Actually, I think it was on our episode where we talked about games after the holidays, when we came back from the holiday break, what games we've played. I want to say it was that one.
Or Drones v. Gowlands? Is it Gowlands? Or
it's Goéland.
Oh,
it's
yes,
French. Like... Yeah, you got a Goéland.
Goéland.
Yeah.
There we go.
So that's the only way you can currently buy the game. There is a French version available and no other available version. There are English rules that are available. It's also able to be played on Board Game Arena or BGA. If you want to play there, absolutely ask me. rcampbell04 is my username. I will play any game, anytime of Drones versus Seagulls with you. I love this little package that it's got. It is essentially a battle line game. So along the lines of Battle Line or Shot and Totten, there's essentially different outposts that you and your opponent, this is a two-player only game as well, I should say, where you and your opponent are playing cards to specific locations, and the ultimate goal is to have control of all seven of those locations, or after all cards have been played, having majority control of locations. The reason why I think for me this game wins out above those other lane battler type games is the outposts, as they are called in Drones versus Seagulls, these locations, have abilities on their own. So in most line battler games, usually the factions that you pick or the cards that you have will determine what abilities you get. So, for example, Battle Line, when you're playing your cards to a certain location, the three cards you play, depending on the numbers that you get or the suits or the colors that you play, will determine the strength at that location and what your opponent needs to beat. It ends up becoming easier to plan around because you know what your opponent's going for at a location, so it's easy to combat. Whereas in Drone versus Seagulls, to trigger the ability, you have to gain control of it when it was on your opponent's side to start. So if I played a card at a location that I already control, nothing's going to happen. No ability triggers because I already control it. My card just goes there and makes the strength harder for my opponent to win. And so the whole idea of this game, and it's perfect information, I should also add, the cards that you get are the exact same cards that your opponents get. It's numbers 1 through 5. There's varying numbers of each card. You have the exact same deck makeup. It's those outposts that are different.
And the seagulls and the drones, right? Because they're...
Of course, the artwork, depending on which one you pick, which I always will go seagulls, because the seagull artwork is the greatest.
Pretty great.
So good. Pretty great. But the idea of sort of trying to figure out that puzzle, it very much comes down to almost an abstract game. So if you don't really like two-player abstract games, this game might not be for you. Because this game is very susceptible to AP, analysis paralysis. The fact that you can make crazy combinations of things. If I play a card and gain control of an outpost, I trigger that ability. Well, that ability might allow me to do something else at another outpost, which I gain control of, and I trigger that ability. And then I do something off of that outpost, which triggers another ability. And all of a sudden, I'm doing like 3 or 4 different things on my turn.
Would you say, Ryan, that with this triggering of abilities, does it almost feel a bit like when you play a roll and write game or a flip and write game, when you do one thing and that cascades into another and that cascades into something else, and that kind of way of thinking? And if you would that appeal potentially to people who like that sort of game? Okay, it's very different, but it's that way of thinking.
No, I think that's actually a great analogy or a great way to think of it as far as those combinations. It feels very combo-tastic, like roll and writes do. There can be times where you can re-trigger the same outpost depending on the order of things, and it feels really clever. And I'm going to use the word clever again.
Yeah, you didn't use interesting this time. I've been listening for it. I haven't heard it, so I'm not sure this one's...
No, this one I think transcends beyond interesting.
Oh, I see. Okay, that's different.
The fact that some of the outposts that you can do have the ability to move one of your cards that's already been played, or move one of your opponent's cards, or recruit one of your opponent's cards. So you take one of your opponents and bring it to your side and add it to your strength. There's other ones that you can destroy your opponent's cards or take another turn. So you can see if you can find the right way to activate these outposts in the right order, you can do some of them multiple times. Because the really important minutia rule in this game is the active player always chooses which outpost gets flipped whenever there are multiple outposts that need to be flipped.
So this almost, and I have played this, by the way, and it felt to me, as you're describing it, flashbacks of that play happening in my head. I played this game is available on Board Game Arena. Spoiler alert to play. A very good implementation is on there, and it's a great way to try it. I'm an owner of Shotten Totten, Ryan, as the original, if you like, is at the battle line. And if Shotten Totten to me is a vanilla ice cream, this is an ice cream with many different flavors, chocolate sauce all over it, and a few flakes thrown in it as well, just because of all this extra stuff that you can do, this extra layer of decision making, an extra layer of wackiness.
Yeah, and it has been a while, admittedly, since I've played Shotten Totten and Shotten Totten 2. And they are definitely different itches to scratch. They both are certainly line battlers. They do share that DNA of two-player-only games. You're trying to gain control of locations. Drones versus Seagulls is absolutely a little bit wackier, more combo-tastic, as I've said. You have to be a little bit more open to... Your opponent could win in one turn. If they can figure out that puzzle and match all of those combos right, you might have 5 of the 7 outposts on your control. But you have to remember, if you're in control of an outpost, That means it's an easier chance that your opponent is going to be able to gain control of that outpost on their turn and trigger that ability. The more abilities that you have access to trigger on your turn means the more combos you can make, which I love about the game. That creates the really fun moments of how far do I push the amount of outposts that I can gain control of. If I can't get all seven this turn, maybe I only gain one. I could get three, but if I gain three outposts, I'm just going to make it easier for my opponent to do other crazy combos.
Yeah, and when I was playing this kind of decision-making, I found, I'm going to use it now, interesting. There we go, I've said it. To put an adjective into perspective, Ryan. So when I played this game with my friend online, and we had a good time with it, and I explained the rules to him, even though there is a little bit of this negative player interaction, you know, when you're destroying a card or taking a card over to your side, it never feels that personal because this game is over and done really quickly. And like you said, it could be over in one go. I mean, let's be honest, that normally if you've got a couple of plays under your belt, that doesn't happen that often. And normally you'll get quite an there we go, I'm saying it again. Normally you'll get an interesting play out of the game. I enjoyed it. I played it a few times. And you are, to me, a what you were to Yokai Septic to Drones versus Seagulls. I'm not going to say the Seagull Man, but you had that as your profile picture for some time. And that really demonstrates to me your love for this game really comes through. And I'm sure it's coming through to the people who are listening that, to me, this game certainly warrants a try if you like the sound of it and how Ryan's described it.
Yeah, I will say this is a game you might need to give two, potentially three plays to really decide if it is something you'd like or not. I understand if you have a really bad first play, it's hard to come back from that and try it again. But having played it so many times, and I feel like I get the game well enough to know what that puzzle is to figure out. And as we said, Eggs of Ostrich is a little samey. To me, Drones versus Seagulls is not as samey as that. Sure, the outposts, they're only a limited number. You can randomize them every game, so it can be different, the order and the combination you have available. But the idea and how the game works is always still going to be there. The thing is, like I said, this is almost a two-player abstract game. And like most two-player abstract games, power level is important. Expertise will shine in this game. If you play somebody who's a master at chess and you've never played chess before, you're going to get destroyed. And I feel like in Drones versus Seagulls, if you've never played this game before and you've played it with somebody who has, more than likely, it's not to the aggressive level that chess might be, but there's a good chance that you're probably going to get outplayed to start. And this is a game where you have to almost be at the same level as somebody else to make sure that the game can be enjoyed. And I know for me, as I said, I've played this game a lot and I keep tossing it out there. Play with me on BGA, R. Campbell 04. The idea that when I play with new people, I kind of have to pull back my punches.
Run your seagulls in.
Yeah, I want to make sure that they enjoy the game enough to try and play with me again. Now, I'm not a guru at this game. I'm not going to say I've won every time. I have lost, and that's fine. But majority of the time, I am winning because I am playing with newer people who don't understand the idea and the flow of the game.
As you were describing this, Ryan, I just had visions of you turn up to the World Chess Tournament and you'd be like, well, I know you can beat me at chess, but have you tried to beat me at Drones versus Seagulls? That could be a sort of a...
Oh, you'd absolutely beat me in chess. I'm terrible at chess and I will have no problem admitting that.
But Drones versus Seagulls, I'm trembling in my boots. But seriously, I think from the way you described it, experience shines through, but that also is to the game's credit because that means there is a layer of tactical strategic decision making where you can improve as you know, the more players you get under your belt, which shows to me that there is some depth to the game.
No, certainly. I think more I've played it now with some of the people that I've continued to play 5, 6, 7 plus games with it, we're starting to see more rounds go to the entire hands.
Nice.
Yeah, the round's not ending 3-4 cards in where we're taking control of all 7 outposts. We're actually playing out the entire hand, which is great.
Metagame, would you say as well, this one?
Yeah, I think you could have a metagame. As I said, there's the same deck makeup between each players at range 1 through 5. And because of that, how you play your cards and in what order can absolutely be a thing. There's been some players that I play against that are more aggressive that play their 5s and their 4s as their openers.
Okay.
Where there are other people who play their 1s and their 2s as openers. It can obviously depend on what tokens, what outposts are available. Because whenever you have the destroy card or the recruit card, it's always scary to play your 5s and 4s early because they can easily get destroyed or recruited and hurt you. There are players that I've played against where even if those are out there, they'll still just gung-ho.
They'll still do the pattern that's trying to understand that pattern, which is, again, we're coming back to, I think, the point here of games bringing people together, the social interaction, the laughter of Eggs of Ostrich, and this one, you know, trying to get into the head of your opponent and understanding what they're about and how they're going to make that cascading puzzle work for them and work and how it's going to work for you. I don't want to say interesting again, but it strikes me as an intriguing little puzzle. And having had played it, it's one that I would like to play more and experiment with and see how it develops with the person that I have played this with before.
Absolutely. Well, you know somebody you can play against.
Oh, is his name Ryan? Does it begin with an R by any chance?
It happens to. The username is rcamel04, if I haven't said that.
So there is the booty call for drones versus seagulls.
And I feel like this harkens back to our last Tea Time episode, which just came out right before this, where we talk about the difficulty of buying new games and everything. And as it's always going to be hard as we talk about these games and we hype them up as much, the fact that this is available to try for free before you'd buy it is a great option and one that I would strongly recommend you do, whether it's against me or your friends or family members.
You know his username now. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely try this game before you buy it, or just try it in general. Whether you do or don't buy it, it's up to you. BGA, great spot to try it. Oh boy. All right. Well, I think we should move on.
There we go. The next game can be played with a standard deck of cards. That's how I started with this game, Ryan. I then bought the game. I then sold the game and decided to play it again with a normal deck of cards because I missed the game. And that game is Regicide. So
I think that's a perfect summary of this game, honestly.
There we go. That's it. It lures you back in eventually, a bit like Bottle Imp did with me, but this is a non-trick takers episode, so maybe I shouldn't even say the name. The imps always get their way in the end. But Regicide. So back to Regicide. It's a cooperative fantasy card game where you are using, for all intensive purposes, a standard deck of cards or the lovely production that is also available for purchase, which again is just the deck of cards, but the artwork's pretty great. There's an app that accompanies this game if you want to use it, which I also recommend. Yeah, it's got little background music in there. It kind of holds your hand as you're playing, so you don't need to think about too much about the scoring. You can just kind of get on with the game and enjoy it. But you're trying to defeat powerful enemies, and these powerful enemies are kings, queens, and jacks that make up a standard deck of cards or the production version. And as you're fighting the jacks, then the queens, and then the kings, things are going to get progressively harder for you depending on which enemy you are fighting. Like I said, the players are working together, so you've got this lovely cooperative element to it. And the game ends when the last king is defeated. But these cards, or the face cards, if you like, they fight back, So whenever you attack the cards, you all get to play a card. The card that you'll play depends on how you, the value of your enemy, how much they health they have, how much you need to play to defeat them. But then they sort of hit back. And if one of the players is eliminated, then the whole team loses. There's only limited communication. There are some special cards that do different things. The different suits do different things when you you have a pile of cards on the table. I'm trying to remember, and it's a very rough explanation, but there's some suits that give you restore your health. There are some that allow you to draw more cards to, you know, from the deck, so you've got more in your hand and replenish the hand of the other players who are also playing the game too. And the suit of the enemy, so say for example the King of Hearts, also has an effect on, well, I believe they have immunity to their own suit, you know, as far as the powers are concerned and what different things do in the game. But all in all, really nice little package. Something very, very different I never thought I'd see with a standard deck of cards. I don't even want to use the word dungeon crawler, but I think that's kind of what it's going for, isn't it? You know, French deck, dungeon crawler.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very distilled...
very distilled.
Yeah, idea of what that game is going for. I don't want to say Gloomhaven, but like if you were to take Gloomhaven and distill it to like 1% of that game...
at its heart, right?
Yeah, yeah, you'd get Regicide. So no, I love what it's doing with a standard deck of cards. So this is an easy one that you probably don't even need to go and buy because you more than likely have one in your household somewhere. Yeah. The fact that it's cooperative is always great for card games like this, being able to come together and figure out how to, you know, puzzle out the idea of how to take down this character. And I love that every suit has a power. And as you said, whatever current enemy you're against, it essentially negates that power. So trying to time your attacks and your abilities all while not running out of cards, because that's ultimately, as you said, you know, when one player gets eliminated, it's, you know, running out of cards. You're taking damage. So you're also trying to figure out what cards do I play to attack with and what cards can I defend with. To me, this is a really great puzzle. And it's almost... I don't want to say multi-hand solitaire because it's still very cooperative in what you're deciding.
Yeah, it's still got a cooperative element, yeah.
Yeah, but as you said, because of the fact that there's limited communication with the whole table, when you decide to attack and what you decide to defend with ultimately comes down to you personally. What are you going to do on your turn? And I think that speaks volumes to the game, though, because it creates that fun, as you sort of dungeon crawling-y vibe of...
Gloomhaven light, right?
yeah. Gloomhaven light. While you are working together and making these decisions, if you think about it like thematically, if you're in a dungeon together and all these things are attacking you, you have to decide on your own what you're going to do. You might be able to call out to each other, oh, we should, you know, let's flank on the left and do this, but... in the heat of the moment, you have to make the decision on your own. And I think it shines really well in this game of making those decisions.
Yeah, like you said, everything has a purpose. The suits, the double damage, the shield. There is a jester card, depending on the player count as well. And you can kind of then have a bit of a communication piece with the players and see who wants to take on the challenge of and pass. And that's the little bit of agency you have there as well, which is nice. Mm-hmm. Never thought, like I said, I'd see a standard deck of cards used in this way. And we talk about so many games with cards and evolutions of cards, which we see in modern Trick Takers and Climbers. And this still stands out as something that is so unique in a world of card games. I haven't seen anything else that does what this does. Anything else quite like it. So if you're looking for something unique for your collection or just want to play something really unique with a standard deck of cards, Gloomhaven light is Regicide.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great option to pick. And as we said, it uses a standard deck of cards, so it doesn't really require you to spend that much money. Even if you buy the official version, I think it's maybe $10 or $15.
Yeah, and one more thing I will add, Ryan, is some people don't like to use apps with modern games, and sometimes it's not practical to use an app. But that's okay. You can play without the app. I know I bought some D20 dice, some black ones and some red ones, to use as trackers, and I thought, well, if I don't have the scoring app, then this would be helpful so I can see what stage people are at with their lives and their health. But in the end, I conceded that everybody just wanted to press a button on the app, and that works for me. But whatever works for your group. So don't be put off if you think, oh, I need the app, because you absolutely don't. It just makes life a bit easier for scoring, but it's not essential.
Yeah, for sure.
So next on our list, I know you're dying to talk about this one, I could butcher this. Hanamijikoji. There we go. I had some Japanese lessons before. You can't tell, can you?
Hanamijikoji.
There we go.
Yeah, Hanamijikoji is one of my most played two-player only card games. And I've had the pleasure to be able to play the expansions. There's like seven, I guess, mini expansions you could call them. Recently with one of my local friends here. And we went through all seven of them in two separate nights. We played the first four and then the last three. Mm-hmm. It's essentially an I cut, you choose game with a little bit of twist in it. But ultimately, there are different geishas in the middle of the table that you're trying to earn their favor from. And you do that by having the majority of the cards of that specific geisha. And they range from number 2 to 5. And the number that that geisha has will tell you how many copies of that card are in the deck. So the number 2 geisha only has 2 cards. The number 5 geisha has 5 cards. The thing is, though, not all of the cards are going to get played to the locations. So as long as you just have the outright majority. So at a 2 geisha, you could have a single card there, and that might win you that geisha because your opponent doesn't have a card. The idea, though, is that you have these 4 tokens in front of you that are numbered 1, 2, 3, and 4. And the number that's on that token will tell you how many cards you're essentially going to interact with. So the number 1 token makes you interact with 1 card. Depending on if you're playing the base game or one of these 7 expansions will change what it does. But for example, it might just be you score this 1 card. It's going to go face down in front of you. That card will score for you at the end of the round. And then the 2 section means you're going to interact with 2 cards. So maybe you place these 2 cards face up, your opponent picks 1, you keep the other. The 3 and the 4 make you interact with 3 and 4 cards,
that's
respectively.
That's the I split, you choose thing, isn't it? Your opponent picks 1, you pick the other. That's where it comes from, I think.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. Ultimately, you're going to be making these choices of picking cards from your hand to put out on the table for your opponent to decide to take some, and you're going to keep the rest. And the expansion essentially just does what the base game does, but in different variations. All 7 expansions are almost similar to each other. Like, there are repeats. The exact same token in one expansion might be in one of the other expansions. It just might be on a different number. The main overall arching flow of the game is almost the same in the expansions. The thing is, though, after playing all 7 of them, there are some that we liked more than others.
Right.
Because there was, I want to say it was the 2nd or 3rd expansion in the set, where there's a lot of hidden information. So most of the time, and especially the base game and a lot of the other expansions, when you're doing things, it's all face up. So the 4 card one, you're choosing 2 sets of 2 cards, and these are face up, and your opponent picks one of the sets to score, you score the other. Well, in the expansions, there's one where you take all 4 cards and you put them face down, and then your opponent just randomly picks one of them to get removed from the game, and then you'll score the other 3. And then there's another one where you just score two cards face down. And then another one where you just remove a card and it's not going to get scored. So it creates what normally happens in the base game to be a lot of public information. And you make choices off of what your opponent's doing and what you're splitting and choosing. When you add this extra element of more hidden information, it becomes a little bit more chaotic. So it can certainly put people off in that regard. But it creates a really interesting, and here it goes, an interesting.
Here we go. This is the first time I've heard it for this thing. Yeah.
So while the expansions, I think on a grand scheme, are very similar, they all are just subtle enough changes that it does change up the way the game is looked at. And I don't want to say played, because the process is the same, but how you look at a turn changes. And to me, that was really fascinating with the different expansions and how they progressed. I think playing all seven of them in a very short time frame like we did made it easier to see the similarities. So maybe I wouldn't recommend doing them that quickly.
Yeah, it's not just a case of expansion one, discard one card. Expansion two, discard two cards, you know, and so on. And I also had to check, Ryan, that it wasn't... Because I've got this game. How many... I'm not even going to say it. I've got the game. And I also have promos that were included, and they were seven different art style geishas. So when you said mini expansion, seven mini expansions, I had to check it wasn't just a card per expansion. That sounds interesting the way it changes the game. This game, and it's funny because we're talking about drones versus seagulls, and you're competing for this card in the center, which I guess is a similarity. Clutching at straws a little bit, but there's a card in the center you're both competing for control of. So in that way, it is similar. Obviously, where it differs is with this I split, you choose mechanic and the, as you pointed out. But for me, it's the anxiety of, oh God, I'm going for this one. I really hope that they don't pick that one. And it's all these agonizing decisions because of the public information that's out there. You are both can see the cards and your pulse just starts racing and you get paranoid and you think, you're gunning for yourself totally. But at the same time, you're trying to lure them into taking the card that you don't care about. And it's trying to communicate that in a way where it doesn't look obvious. And for me, that's what's really interesting about the game.
Yeah, it's almost sort of becomes a bluff, double bluff, kind of like Eggs of Ostrich deciding those choices. And how do you split things appropriately? Which is kind of the whole like vibe and idea of I split, you choose.
Yeah.
It's super intense and very agonizing decisions of making sure you don't make a choice so powerful that your opponent just has, oh yeah, this is easy. This is the one to take. But don't leave yourself with such a crappy choice when you do that. The game state changes throughout the round too, which can help or hurt potentially those choices you make. Because if I already have two fives in front of me that I'm going to score for the fives, I just need one more to guarantee I'm going to take it. Well, maybe my opponent is secretly scoring two fives. I don't know that. I just have to kind of guess what they're going for. So that last five is a huge battle between the two of us. Where is it? When's it going to come up?
Headspace. Yeah.
Yeah. And you're doing this for every geisha, not just the five. You're doing it for the fours, the threes, and the twos.
And of course, they're all charming symbols. And we talk about fives and threes and twos. In the game, you know, you've got green tees and fans and umbrellas and these different objects you're also looking at, which is the production is really quite charming. I can't speak to the expansions. How essential, Ryan, are the... And essential is a dangerous word in this hobby. And we've talked about our challenges for the year. Could you ever see a scenario where you just have the base game and not want the expansions, or having played the expansions, are you now a convert?
No, I only own the base game. And after playing all of the expansions, I am still perfectly content with owning the base game. The thing is, as I said, the expansions are almost just mini expansions. They're simply just replacing those little tiles that are in the base game. you could theoretically, if somebody has pictures of them online, or if you have a friend that has it, like you could just scan them or print them out. Not that I'm advertising doing this. Please support your games if you want to get them. But you could play these expansions for free. If you have the base game, you have the cards and the geisha components that you need to play it. It's just those tiles. That's the only difference. And theoretically, you don't even need the tiles. As long as you just know the rules of how it works, you could just say, oh, well, this in this game version we're playing, the one's going to be you just discard a card, and the twos are going to be face down. And like you could just
have a list or something. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And honestly, that makes it ripe for just like fan-made expansions. So for me, the expansions, I don't think are that essential.
Yeah, and I know there's been a few iterations of this game. You know, some of them, instead of geishas, they had some guys in the center. Yeah,
the Jixa Academy.
Yeah, so there's a few different versions of it. Hanuma Jikoji is... there goes my pronunciation. It's gone. It's killing me. Just say it again, Ryan, just so we've got your voice over my talking.
Hanuma Koji.
Hanuma Koji, there we go, said it now.
Hey, perfect.
Yeah, it's staying on my shelf. I rediscovered it again recently after owning it for a long time. Solid game, and I like how all of these games have kind of got an underlying theme of bluffing that we've been talking about. So it's just that, what a coincidence.
Right, yeah. Is it all other card games that aren't trick-taking have bluffing?
There we go. It just so happens.
Well, funny enough, I feel like the next game we're about to talk about has lots of bluffing involved, right?
It does, yeah. Because the way I was sold on this game, what if Texas Hold'em Poker met Liar's Dice? And that really intrigued me. And also, Ryan, because with poker, and I'm not going to go into the rules of Texas Hold'em because we'd probably be here all day. It's a good game, in a nutshell. But this feels like a gamer's version, which is weird for me to say because Texas Hold'em is a game, but this is like a gamer's version of Texas Hold'em that's being gamified in a weird way with pandas. And that's the most important thing because it is Pandante I'm going to be talking about. And specifically, and I want to make sure I get this now and caveat a dozen times. I'm talking about Pandante, the second edition, and I'm not talking about Pandante, the first edition, which I've got no experience with, had quite a few negative reviews, which I feel has hurt this game in some ways, you know, in terms of how people perceive this game on the marketplace. And the irony is, Pandante, the second edition, contains an expansion which apparently makes the game easier, more accessible, and more distilled, which is weird because normally with expansions, you expect them to add bloat and add rules, teach, etc. So that's strange right off the bat. But yeah, when I'm talking about this game, the second edition, which comes in two forms. You can get a deluxe version with loads of clay poker chips and a metal coin, which I've stumbled upon, and also a standard edition. I actually have the standard edition and the deluxe version, Ryan, but I'm moving on the standard edition. It doesn't count as an acquisition. It happened by accident. I ended up with two copies of, well, they are pandas, so it's, you know, can you blame me? They're cute and stuff. But back to the gameplay itself, people don't fold as much as they do with normal poker. And this appealed to me because I like to players to stay in the game as long as they possibly can. I don't like it, you know, when people are eliminated too prematurely. But with this game, there are the familiarities of normal poker. You've got the hands, you've got the full house, the straight flushes, all these kind of lovely things that you get in climbing games. They've replaced one thing, though, Ryan, with it's called a floosh. So we just sort of sat there at the table and had fun saying, oh, well, I've got a floosh. It's not, there is flush, but there's also a floosh, which I believe is...
A flush with a flare?
Yeah, flush with a flare. For four cards of the same suit. There you go. Or four pandas. Yeah, all the cards are basically panda artwork and there's a joker in there. But essentially, when you're playing, you start out, everybody puts some chips into the pot. And you can straight up bluff and say, well, I've got a full house. And somebody else can say, well, I've got a straight. There are literally is a board with in the center with all the different melds on it. And people can straight up say what they've got, which is great because you can easily get intimidated about what people are saying, or maybe they're lying, maybe they aren't. Cards come out like you'd expect in normal poker. But once you say you've got a hand, generally speaking, you can't downgrade it. So that means if you say you've got a straight flush, which is the highest possible hand, you can't be moving down that ladder to say, well, you've only got a pair later on if you change your mind. So you better make sure you've got it, or at least convince other players that you've got it. And every round of betting, like you'd expect, you can fold, like in normal poker where you just hand your cards in and say, I'm done. But the reason why people don't fold so much in this game is because you get what's called snacks. Now, snacks are basically opportunities to draw cards from the deck to improve your hand. So every round of betting, you pull a card off the top of the deck, if you want to, and get a snack. And then improve your hand and discard a card. And so dynamically already, you've changed poker because you're then less likely to fold, knowing that in the future you might increase the strength of your hand just because of the draw. So already, you're improving your hand potentially by drawing cards off the top of the deck, which is really interesting because that is more dynamic than Texas Hold'em vanilla without the pandas.
I feel as though that could appeal to more players that might not like poker normally for its very strict rules of how you have to look at a hand and percentages and probabilities. This sounds like a neat alternative to still kind of get to the idea of poker, but a little bit more lighthearted.
Yeah, I'd say so. You having the opportunities to improve your hand certainly helps. Okay, you could argue that makes it more random, but it's still fun because, Ryan, what happens at the end of the round is if you make it through and saying you've got the best hand, there's some abilities that you can use to augment your hand again and peek at people's cards. And this is what you know we're talking about that normal poker players might not like the idea of. There's a side that's positive interaction and a side that's negative interaction. You decide at the start of the game which side you're going to use, which panda abilities you want. But when you make it into the showdown, so you're saying you've got the highest hand on the table, everybody else gets to simultaneously flip a token and say whether they think you're lying or not. If you are exposed as a liar, you are out, and then it then falls down to the people who then go into the showdown who have got lesser hands or said they've got lesser hands. But the penalty in this game for calling out a liar who wasn't lying is quite high. You've got to pay a lot of chips. So it's not just a case of, oh, everybody always says, oh, you're lying, and then it's just an anticlimax. No, it's interesting. And yes, you've said that, okay, you know, for serious poker players, there is a real money version, a variant in the rule book for real money. Notwithstanding that there are casino cards which change the rule every round. If you run out of money, you get topped up by a gold fairy. But if you spend too much, you have to frolic with her for a round and sit out for the next one. There's all sorts of this crazy terminology and concepts in the game, but at its heart, it does feel very much like Texas Hold'em. More funny, more bluffing, and less player elimination, I would say, which is nice.
Yeah, the idea of almost adding a press your luck element of trying to improve your hand is a cool concept. Because you said it's you can bluff on where your hand is and then still draw an after, which is like, that's awesome. The fact that you could bluff something and then actually make it happen later. Obviously, it's very luck dependent.
Yes.
Yeah. To me, that appeals to my nature of the very risky play that I like to do. I'm very much a Hail Mary and make the big plays. And then when they pay off, it is amazing and it pays out big. I would almost certainly do that every time without real money. You throw in the real money, I'm going to bet nothing.
Then you back out of it. Put your 79 unplayed trick takers on the line. There we go. The fun thing about this, though, is taking that extra card in between betting is available to the person for free who says they've got the highest hand at the time, but everybody else who says they've got lesser hands has to pay chips in order to take this free card. It's not guaranteed. What you're communicating to the players by taking cards or using an ability to drop, you know, discard your hand and draw up again, you're communicating to the players that you've got a weak hand, that you're not confident in what you've said you've got, you probably haven't got. So there's a double bluff there as well. Is, are you confident enough not to have to do that?
Yeah, no, that's great. Now that we're talking about it more and hearing more of how that gameplay plays out, that appeals to me more because I don't really like poker myself. I don't mind it. Played Texas Hold'em is really specifically the one, and I'm pretty sure majority of people, it's probably the one they do play.
Yeah, nobody is.
And yeah, and I've played it enough times. I get a kick out of it. But if I'm going to play a game that's going to be the whole night, there's so many other traditional card games I'd rather play, Doppelkopf being one of them. But the extra layers that this one adds absolutely appeals to me. It's my style of play as far as what additions I would want to have poker to have.
Exactly. And I think with the abilities, being able to choose whether you want the positive player interaction or the negative player interaction and playing like and agreeing to play that way for the duration of the game is really nice as well, because you can totally take the abilities out if you want to as well. They're optional. So are the casino cards that change little rules every round. You can strip all that back as much as you want to, or throw in the optional Panda Lords, which I will caveat we didn't, because they are a relic from the first edition. But it's nice that it gives you a choice. It says this is the game and you do what you want with it. But either way, we've made poker more fun, in my opinion, probably more accessible with a cute theme. And what's not to love about that? So by all means, check it out. Make your own opinion. And if you get a chance to try it, Ryan, maybe if one comes your way again when you're not doing your challenge, pull the trigger.
Yeah, I think this might make my wish list for 2024.
There we are, Pandante. Well, I think the only place we can go from there is thank you all for listening to Trick Talkers. If you do have any comments or recommendations and want to talk about something we've discussed on an episode, feel free to do so. There's also our Discord. You can ask away in there as well. We can be reached on Twitter at TrickTalkers or by email at TrickTalkers@gmail.com. Appreciate you listening. That's all there is left to say. We've been Ryan and Patrick. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Bye.
Bye.